From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. I do have a guest with me today, and we are currently connecting him. But until we do that, I just want to bring your attention to something the FDA has in store for us, which it announced on January 31st of this year, and that is its vision for a reimagined FDA human foods program. If you go to the FDA's website, you can find information on this, and you can find a link to a three-page document outlining this human foods program. This document lists the key elements of a unified human foods program. And essentially, reading here from the document, on January 31, 2023, the FDA provided an update on the agency's new vision for the FDA's human foods program following evaluations released last year. The agency will continue to collaborate with federal partners on a whole-of-government approach to food safety and nutrition. This fact sheet summarizes key components of Commissioner Califf's vision for a unified and reimagined human foods program. That's FDA Commissioner Robert Califf, who served as FDA Commissioner once before this, and in the interim between his two periods of service, he was working in the health department, perhaps you could call it, of Google, of all entities. So take that as you will. Now, this unified human foods program, according to this document, will be created by combining the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, Office of Food Policy and Response, and certain functions of the Office of Regulatory Affairs under one leader. There are some handy charts in here with regard to the FDA's vision of how a unified human foods program will be formed and what this will look like. According to the document, is that an empowered deputy commissioner for human foods will be established to provide executive leadership and strategic direction over the entire portfolio, including resource allocation strategy, risk prioritization, integrated food safety partnership programs, communications, policy initiatives, and cultural transformation. The document does not get into any detail with regard to cultural transformation, but suffice it to say that that does not bode well. Anytime we hear cultural transformation or read cultural transformation, especially when it's coming from bureaucratic, technocratic, globalist entities such as the FDA, it cannot bode well. Certainly the transformation, almost certainly the transformation they have in mind is not a positive transformation for the culture at large. The document goes on to state that a larger executive team for the human foods program will be put in place with clearly defined lines of authority to ensure decisive leadership over the program's vast responsibilities. This includes a principal associate commissioner for human foods position, reporting to the deputy commissioner, to provide strong, effective operational management of the program's day-to-day operations. In addition, a team of executives for the program's major areas of responsibility will be created to provide the necessary management infrastructure. there is, as part of the graphics accompanying this piece, laying out the vision for key executive responsibilities of Deputy Commissioner for Human Foods chart. And this involves stakeholder engagement, policy and strategy, resource management and allocation, national integrated food safety system partnerships, communications, cultural transformation again, and risk prioritization. And this will all be controlled, as stated, by one leader, the Deputy Commissioner for Human Foods, who will report directly to Calif. Now, why this is something we should keep an eye on, and there's more to get into here, but why this is something we should keep an eye on is because, as we've seen, especially over the last year, there's an attack on our food system, our food supply here in the U.S. globally. It's not an isolated attack that's taking place. And regardless of the provenance of these attacks, whether they're acts of God, which I don't think they are, or they are engineered, which I think there's a lot of evidence pointing to the engineering of these attacks, it gives entities like the FDA and larger entities with an international reach the opportunity, if you will, to reimagine our relationship to food. And that is what the FDA is attempting to do here, seeking to do here. I've just been informed that my guest is connected, so I'm going to bring him on, but I will put a pin in this, to use that annoying phrase, and I will come back to it next week, because this is something that deserves scrutiny and deserves our attention in terms of being very wary about what's coming for the food supply in the U.S. and on an international level. That said, I'd like to welcome back to the program Michael Bryant. Michael is a citizen journalist, writer, and researcher who has worked with various anti-war groups, environmental organizations, and anti-globalization organizations on many issues ranging from U.S. imperialism to domestic corporate crimes to the globalization of agriculture. He worked with the Times Beach Action Group regarding dioxin contamination in the St. Louis, Missouri area, and he is one of the founding members of New England Resistance Against Genetic Engineering. He currently works as a writer and researcher for the Health Freedom Defense Fund and as a researcher for the COVID-19 Humanity Betrayal Memory Project, which you can find at chbmp.org. And his work is published frequently at offguardian.org, Health Freedom Defense Fund, Brownstone, Lou Rockwell, Planet Waves FM, and perhaps several other outlets. He can let me know if he wishes, if there are any others. And he's coming to us live from upstate New York. Michael, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Thanks a lot, Jesse. It's good to talk again. And, you know, I think today we're going to talk a lot about Italy, which is appropriate given that, you know, it was almost 3 years ago to the day where the first alleged COVID case in the West was noted in Italy. And shortly thereafter, the COVID hysteria and the COVID operation was launched in northern Italy.
Yes. So why is Italy important? Why was it important in 2020, and why is it still important now to not just forensically examine, as you've been doing, but to piece together what actually happened there?
Well, the relevance of Italy is that it was the very first nation in the world that went into a full lockdown. And the narrative that there was this mysterious super spreading and super lethal virus that was galloping around the world, infecting and killing people, was launched into and onto the Western psyche via these dramatic media reports that were coming out of northern Italy. So, you know, the entire illusion of this viral invasion that was required to launch the PSYOP happened through the launching pad of Italy, through this shock and awe campaign that they used, and then the Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte set the entire stage for the Western world by imposing these national lockdowns in Italy. And so it's very important that we're going to, you know, unpack, you know, were these unprecedented excess deaths, you know, caused by this viral, purported viral event in northern Italy in spring 2020, actually caused by the spread of some novel deadly virus? So the short version is that this is what validated that this invasive virus was going to be sweeping through the West. And the way Italy handled it, though the evidence suggests this wasn't just about Italy making these decisions unilaterally to handle it in a certain way. In any case, the way Italy handled it was then became the template for how this alleged pandemic was to be handled throughout the West. There are some misconceptions that, you know, China was the model. China was the first place where lockdowns occurred, and this simply wasn't the case. It was mm-hmm. It was in Italy. So that's a bit of a short description of why Italy is so important to this. And if possible, at a certain point, I'd like to go through just an abbreviated timeline to place some of this in context and freshen people's memories as to what was happening at that time.
Absolutely. Let's do that right now.
Okay. So two important dates in November of 2019. On November 14th, 2019, the Italian Prime Minister Conte met with the Executive President of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab. 3 days later, on November 17th, the first case of SARS-CoV-2 was dated by the Chinese media. On January 30th, 2020, Italy set to declare coronavirus emergency measures as Prime Minister Conte announced Italy's first two COVID cases, who were purportedly tourists from China. The very next day, on January 31st, the Italian government declared a national emergency in order to face what they called the incoming COVID-19 crisis. They suspended flights to China and confirmed that the two cases were in fact the alleged virus, and those were confirmed in Rome. On February 20th, 2020, the first COVID-19 case of an Italian citizen was diagnosed in Catania. And then on that same day, the first COVID death of an Italian citizen was recorded. That citizen was a 70-year-old Italian from the Veneto region, Adriano Trevisan. He was a retired bricklayer from a village near Padua who had tested positive for the virus and died in the hospital while being treated for pneumonia. And that's kind of somewhat interesting in that many of the accounts that you'll get of this will label his pneumonia as an unrelated disease, when in fact you can find other accounts that specifically cite that he was already in the hospital for pneumonia. February 23rd, 2020, the Italian government introduces the first movement and access exit restrictions around various hotspots known as red zones. On that same day, the Italian Ministry of Health issued PCR testing guidance to 31 labs across Italy. Cases immediately began to surge. March 4th, 2020, nationwide closure of schools and universities are declared in Italy. March 8th, 2020, extension of lockdown restrictions to all Lombardy and large areas of northern Italy are put in place. March 9th, 2020, the government of Italy, under Prime Minister Conte, extends the lockdown nationwide, restricting the movement of the population except for necessity, work, and health circumstances. On March 11, 2020, the day the World Health Organization declared a global pandemic, closure of restaurants, cafes, pubs, recreational centers, etc., all public spaces, kicked in for Italy except for essential services. On March 18, 2020, the European Central Bank proposed a $750 billion euro bailout for the financial sector to fight the coronavirus, what they called the coronavirus crash. On March 22, 2020, cessation of all non-essential production activities, complete lockdown of factories, and all non-essential production is halted in Italy. March 25, 2020, further restrictions are imposed to people's movements except for essential reasons. For example, work, health, and getting supplies. So that is the brief timeline of how things began to unfold in late winter and early spring 2020 in Italy. And when we're speaking about this, we're speaking speaking about the alleged cases, alleged deaths, and the all of the hysteria and all of the events surrounding the corona crisis. We're speaking specifically to northern Italy, not the entirety of the country.
Mm-hmm. So just to back up, you started that timeline in November of 2019. Did I get that? Did I hear that correctly?
Yes, that's correct. November 14th was the first date that I cited.
Okay, and you said that China labeled its first case of SARS-CoV-2 at that point?
It was reported by the Chinese media on February 17th of 2019. The first case of SARS-CoV-2.
February or November?
November 17th, 2019.
And did the Chinese media call it SARS-CoV-2?
On that point, I'm not exactly sure. That's how it was being reported through the mainstream press, but I don't have the specific details on how the Chinese public health authorities reported it. And I think there's also, I think there can be a lot of speculation, valid speculation, as to how this was getting reported by the Chinese media and what Western influences were involved in reporting this, perhaps under the guise of it being a report from the Chinese media.
Mm-hmm. So suffice it to say, it was being branded in the media at that time as a new and novel coronavirus?
That's correct.
Okay. So I home in on that point because I was unaware of that early date that it was being that SARS-CoV-2, the alleged non-existent virus, was being identified that early. I thought the identification came a bit later than that. So that's news to me, but I've heard plenty about this alleged virus being in circulation before things started saturating the media in December and January of 2019 and 2020, respectively. So I'm not surprised that it was infiltrating the public consciousness in November of 2019, but again, I ask because that's news to me. So getting back to Italy.
Well, you know, I'll just add to that. It was, you know, it was in the Hubei province in China, and you know, it purportedly was a 55-year-old individual from that province, and I'm not aware of any papers, any studies that back that up, that confirm that, and identify who that person was. The original reports were, you know, linking this to the wet market story, which I think has since thoroughly been decimated. But I don't know, even at that time, were they saying that this was had been specifically identified as SARS-CoV-2. I'm not sure that matters in the end, but that's the story. You can go, you know, you can go read about this at the South China Morning Post, and you can see where they're citing that this is the first case of this alleged virus.
Okay, I'm not aware of any paper either, and I've done a lot of research into the early papers purporting isolation and identification of SARS-CoV-2, and I have not encountered anything from November. But again, it doesn't surprise me that the narrative was being seeded that early. Getting back to Italy and the timeline you just laid out, what measures in terms of health, public health, so-called public health, outside of the lockdowns were imposed to ostensibly mitigate this alleged virus and the alleged disease it causes? So what was being done in terms of hospitals and care homes?
The measures were much like we've seen, what we saw everywhere. You know, these were measures that were stay at home, don't come to the hospital unless you're severely afflicted, and if so, then once you come to the hospital, you are going to be tested, and then if you were tested positive, you are going to be put on protocols. The protocols, much like elsewhere in Italy, were putting individuals on ventilators and putting them on sedation, mainly midazolam. On the nursing homes, they were, again, like elsewhere, isolating elderly people, denying them visits from relatives, and reducing and eliminating in-person visits from health and social carers entirely. So it's hard to say that, you know, these were health measures. It's hard to justify them as health measures. And Italy, in particular, was, as this was happening, was seeking out ventilators from different parts of Europe, as they felt they were not going to have enough. And now we know that these ventilators have an unusually high death rates for the quote-unquote coronavirus patients once they're put on ventilators. And the sedatives that they were using were the very same sedatives that you'll find being used in to put down death row inmates.
Mm-hmm.
And they're using these in quantities that were unusual. And these are known upper respiratory inhibitors, which seems to be the last thing that you would want to use when you are dealing with a upper respiratory infection.
Mm-hmm. So essentially what was done, as was done in many, many locations around the world, was that people were isolated, people were stressed, and people were killed iatrogenically. They were murdered by medical procedures, if you want to be so generous as to call them that. And this gave the impression that there was indeed a virus circulating and causing a deadly disease. That's essentially what we're talking about here, correct?
Yes, and you know, it's important to note that, you know, all of these drugs, the, you know, the morphine sulfate, midazolam, levomethamazine, all these drugs have contraindications listed on them, you know, with side effects, including respiratory depression and respiratory arrest. So, you know, these hospitalized people were essentially coming in with perfectly normal and in many cases reversible, you know, seasonal respiratory infections, and then they're treated with respiratory depressants. So this is a recipe for killing a lot of people who, you know, many of these people were very fragile to begin with, and, you know, perhaps we can go over some of the issues that have been facing this region of northern Italy for, you know, almost two decades now, which has brought about, you know, what you would call the perfect storm for any sort of upper respiratory infections.
Yes, let's get into that, particularly the history of pollution in the Po River Valley and the health impacts of that, and also the austerity measures of the last two decades or so, and what this has done to Italy's health infrastructure and the health indices in the aging population, particularly of northern Italy. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So Italy has been registering high death rates year in and year out, particularly among the elderly during the winter season. And most of these are related to some form of influenza epidemics. So, you know, we can go back to 2013-14 season, where Italy had around 7,000 excess deaths that were attributed to influenza epidemics. By the time we're at 2016-2017, we're at around 24,900 of these excess deaths attributable to influenza epidemics. So, you know, that's almost a fourfold increase in just that short amount of time. So we're looking at a situation that was already existing. This isn't a new situation. Now, in the Po River Valley, it is considered to have the worst air quality in all of Europe. And its pollution is so bad that of the 10 areas in 10 European cities that have the highest death rate from fine particulate matter, six of them are in northern Italy, with Bergamo being at the top of the list. Brescia is also, you know, at the top of the list, and so on. And all these are in the Lombardy region, which is where, you know, the so-called pandemic occurred. At the same time, as you said, we have an aging population. Italy has the oldest population in all of Europe as well, who are in this precarious position. At the same time, we have a large number of these individuals that are residing in institutions and rest homes in Italy. So if you will look into the number of rest homes in Italy, you'll see a stark contrast between how many per capita are in northern Italy versus southern Italy. It's a different culture. In the south, most of the elderly live with their children. They have extended families, whereas in the north, a greater number live in some sort of care facility. So we've got this high level of pollution. We also are dealing with a area geographically which is known, the Po River Valley, which has unusually low winds, and as well has this unique inversion situation where the cold air sits under the warm air. And so the aerosol pollutants get trapped in that, and the pollutants are not able to disperse as well as they would otherwise. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at a place with dangerous air quality, horrible water pollution due to livestock industry, the livestock industry, particularly the hog farming in Italy, is notoriously lax in its regulations and has had a history of polluting rivers throughout northern Italy rather severely. And then the soil in northern Italy is also due to all sorts of industrial activity is known to be fairly poisoned as well. So, you know, we have essentially a constellation of factors here which has made northern Italy an incubator for having any sort of upper respiratory infection. We don't need to introduce a novel virus to be having this, and in fact this has been happening for quite some time in northern Italy and getting worse. Now, with that, introduce this hysteria and these lockdowns, and what do we think will happen? You know, if we combine the effects of all of these, we have what we could call a epidemic of hysteria, an epidemic of iatrogenic deaths, and an epidemic of public health despotism.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. And what is important to emphasize here is that none of what happened in Italy in early 2020 requires a virus or an alleged virus to explain. It doesn't require a pathogen to explain. It can be explained, as you just laid out, by the environmental factors, the terrain factors, and the addition to that of psychological and physical assaults on human beings. And you're going to get results that could be and were in fact distorted into looking like a pandemic in terms of excess mortality. But when you consider all of the factors, the terrain factors, and then you consider how viral epidemics are supposed to work, and again, I'm speaking from within the framework of the virus paradigm, which does not hold water, but it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make epidemiological sense what happened in Italy if you're using the virus narrative to explain that, because while we saw this destruction of human beings in northern Italy, nothing was happening in southern Italy, correct? Or very little was happening.
Yep. That's exactly correct. So you have to ask yourself, how come this the most transmissible and deadliest virus in recent history wasn't able to migrate south? But of course, that's absurd. You know, that it had nothing to do with any viral spread. It had all to do with conditions that were in place, and then human actions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To bring economics into this, because I think, as you and I have talked about, it was in our first conversation, economics, especially macroeconomics, I see as the overarching driver of the last 3 years and everything that's tentacled off of that in 3 years time and counting. And we talked about the repo market crisis last time, but there was a lot more happening on the global macroeconomic level than the repo market crisis of 2019. And there was a lot happening in Italy in terms of macroeconomics that could possibly explain why, in one regard, Italy was chosen as the test bed for the COVID-19 operation in the West. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I'd like to just speak a little bit to the devastation of the Italian hospital infrastructure, which connects directly
yes.
to this. So, you know, if we look at the state of hospitals in northern Italy long before the pandemic kicks in, what we see is a pretty clear pattern that has been ongoing as Italy has been forced into what they call austerity measures. So, you know, we're essentially looking at 30 years of cuts to the Italian national healthcare system, and so this has really stressed the system out in its ability to cope with the aging population and the growing population. So, just as a few data points, from 2009 to 2017, 5% of healthcare staff was cut, which resulted in 47,000 fewer workers. In the last 10 years, they've lost 70,000 beds, and in acute medical units, bed availability per 100,000 inhabitants in Italy in 1980 was 922. Today, it's been cut down to 262 for each 100,000 inhabitants. That's in acute medical units. In intensive care units, there are throughout Italy only 5,090 beds for a population of 60 million. And 50%, half those beds are occupied during normal time, just during regular time. So the Italian healthcare system has been wiped out, completely wiped out, and it is now down to only 6.5% of its GDP. And even according to the World Health Organization, they state that is incapable of guaranteeing the right to basic healthcare. Okay, so with that in mind, this caused an even greater stress for this you know emergency, this sort of self-created, government-created emergency. So in any case, what we have here now are the Italian government imposing these austerity measures because the financial sector has essentially plundered the Italian economy. And the financial sector, as it has in one country throughout the West after the next, has destroyed social services to finance its casino. They have destroyed all public health systems as a part of this. They have bankrupted pension funds as a part of this. And they all knew that this was happening, as we've spoken about before. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So Italy at this time is called in Europe the sick man of Europe. And they're referring to not just the physical condition of the Italian citizens and the known high rates of cancer and interstitial pneumonia and so forth, but also to its economic situation. Okay, their economy was had ground to a halt in 2019, and they were looking for a bailout. Okay, and this bailout came in the guise of a bailout for COVID, to counteract the economic decline caused by the coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
So this is essentially a Ponzi scheme. And when we say bailout, this bailout is going to the financial sector.
Right.
So as of,
right.
You know, for example, we saw on May 14th, 2020, Italy approving a 55 billion euro bailout package after the two-month lockdown. Okay, mm-hmm. And then we saw shortly thereafter, Italy began to relax the lockdown.
Mm-hmm. And this is in line with what we saw globally, what we saw in the U.S. in particular. And as you said, it was the identification of a problem, a macroeconomic problem, a problem with the international monetary and financial system and its regional hubs, if you will. This was identified by the G7 bankers in August of 2019 in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and something desperately and something drastic needed to be done to at least temporarily staunch the problem they'd identified. And overall, that came in the form of the COVID-19 operation, but the operation also served to exacerbate the already existing macroeconomic conditions and provide an excuse for these atrocious bailouts. And it was an obvious case of problem reaction solution. And again, factoring in all that we've gone through with regard to Italy's history of health and austerity and the decline in its healthcare infrastructure, it seems that not just was macroeconomic policy driving this, but Italy was chosen, I would say, as a test bed for what would then expand to the rest of the Western world. And I think it's hard to argue that it wasn't chosen, although chosen by whom, I don't know. The Bank for International Settlements, maybe, I can only speculate, but I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Yes, I think most definitely Italy was chosen. Italy was the perfect incubator for this. So, they didn't have to do that much to create the conditions that would mirror what they consider to be a viral pandemic. The conditions were already in place. So we have high pollution, dangerous living conditions, aging population, all the things that we have labeled, and it doesn't take much to, you know, light a flame under that and ignite a mass hysteria and the appearance that there's a severe situation here that is needing emergency measures. Now, you could make the case that there are severe situations there that require emergency measures, such as cleaning up the environment, maintaining social services, and so forth. But that doesn't make any money for the people who have been doing these things. So, you know, it's the classic case where they are using this virus, the germ, the microbe, as their cover story, okay, to cover up the conditions that they have created. And then they've made money off of the industrial activity, and then they have been able to create this situation where people must get locked down, okay, and then demand that to get these people out of lockdown, they must get bailed out, and then they make money off of that as well. They've mm-hmm. also made money off of plundering the social services, okay? And so this is a big money spinner for them, and they're essentially holding people hostage, okay? and saying until we get this bailout, we have to keep these emergency measures in place. Okay,
right.
When there is no emergency, as they say it. You know, and it's also important to realize that just the level of fraud and deceptive reporting that was involved in all of this.
You yes.
Know, there's pictures, famous pictures of coffins piling up in Bergamo. And these are spread throughout the Western media. You know, I remember seeing them here and created alarm. Well, it turns out those coffins were from 2013. And mm-hmm. these were actually the victims of a shipwreck off the coast of Lampedusa. Okay. But by the time people find out the reality of it, it's too late. The hysteria has been created. So there isn't a single facet of this where once you dig into it just a little bit, you see that it's either been outright lying or utterly decontextualized to get the effect, to get
right.
the idea that there is something out there that is attacking us, instead of you know, having us notice the very entities that are attacking us are the ones that are profiting from all of this, you know. And, you know, I'd like to just add, this is all really coming home to me as I was listening to your introduction, and you were talking about Times Beach, how my alarm bells really went off in February of 2020 with all of this COVID nonsense was through these reports in Italy. Now, when I was working with the Times Beach Action Group, we would hear that Times Beach, the dioxin contaminated soil in Times Beach was the second worst in the history of yada yada. Okay, so we would always wonder, well, where was the first? And it ends up it's in Seveso, Italy, and Seveso, Italy is in this region in northern Italy, and that was due to an industrial accident in 1976. So you know, if you're 20 years old in 1976, you're probably, you know, you're in your early to mid 60s here in circa 2020. And one of the known effects of dioxin is that it, you know, wherever it goes, cancer clusters follow. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So now we go to Nembro, this village that is, it's a small village up in the Lombardy region and, near Seveso. And the men in particular, but women as well, are noted for having high rates of cancer in this village. And then throughout the Seveso region, it's known that there are high rates of cancer throughout this region. And this is another epidemiological fact that has been whitewashed. And so here we have in Nembro high rates of people getting afflicted by this supposed novel virus here in 2020, spring 2020, and dying from this. No, it wasn't their cancer. It wasn't anything like this. It's now take a phony PCR test, get tested positive, okay, and you're a COVID death. It's not your mm-hmm. cancer, which is caused by that industrial accident from, 40 years ago. And this is all hits home, seeing what we've seen here just in the last 2 weeks in the cover-up that's happening there in East Palestine, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
when the main agent of concern, I think we're going to find, is dioxin again.
Yes, I agree. And that's something I've been covering this week, especially. And I'll be speaking with Eric Coppolino of Planet Waves FM, whom you know and you've spoken to previously. I'll be speaking with him next week about that because he's done extensive research and journalistic coverage of past dioxin disasters. And as soon as I read through the material you provided me and learned about the contamination event in Italy in 1976, I thought, here we go again. This is the toxin that just won't stop giving.
Yeah, Eric knows a lot about that topic, and more specific to the cancer that is being seen in Nembro. It's lung cancer was the most common type, and that's the leading cause of death among Nembro men, leading into this so-called pandemic. But this is all swept under the table by the story of the virus. Now it's all the virus, and it provides cover for the governments to not have to do anything about these things, not have to attend to these matters by cleaning up the situation. It also, we don't have to attend to any of these health matters that we have caused, because it's not our doing. It's a virus that has landed from outer space that is impacting you, not these horrendous living conditions which we have forced upon you.
Right. And all of what we've been talking about is also very important. I think more important now than ever before, because a number of people in what's sometimes called the health freedom movement are perpetuating this unfounded idea that some sort of toxin was released intentionally in selected locations, Italy being one of them, New York being one of them, Seattle being one of them, Wuhan being one of them, and that these toxins were self-limiting so that they made people sick and then disappeared. And there's no evidence for this whatsoever. There's no toxin that's been identified. There's nothing. I don't know where this narrative came from and why it's being perpetuated, but it's probably that obfuscates everything that we've just talked about here and the murderous fraud that's taken place. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that, if you have any.
Yes, I mean, anytime you have to go deeper into esoteric theories to explain something, that tells you you're on the wrong path. And just look at the evidence. The evidence is voluminous, and it's rather conclusive as to what has been going on. And you don't need to get into any of these crazy theories about targeted spread, or the limited spread, or this thing has only been able to hit these areas but not hit these areas because of the way they determined the aerosolization of it and all this. This is absolute insanity. We know what was being done in the hospitals. Okay, that evidence is out there on the table for everybody, for example. So we can see exactly that this was administrative slaughter, that these were human agents that were causing these actions. And I think that's probably hard for some people to come to terms with. It's easier to abstract it away to thinking that they were able to slip this virus through the air into certain areas. So did they just select poor areas? No wealthy people are impacted by this. Did they, so you see the absurdity of this in many different ways. If you look at, even as we're focusing on Northern Italy, if you look at the quote unquote outbreaks or where the pandemic impacted people, it didn't even impact people in the outlying areas in these cities and towns. It didn't impact people on the streets of these cities and towns. It only impacted people in the nursing homes and hospitals. So how are they getting this spread in there? Are they targeting these nursing homes and hospitals and these elderly people? Now, I would argue they probably did target elderly people in Europe and elsewhere, but not through aerosolized spread, through the way they forced them onto ventilators and all the various toxic cocktails they were put them on. And one could make the argument this was known, that this was going to do this to people, and this was going to alleviate a lot of the stresses on the broken and plundered pension systems. These people that were dying were forced under new health protocols, okay? These mortality hotspots were all centered around healthcare institutions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And these were mostly institutionalized people, okay? The only things that are spreading around the globe are tyranny, a WHO pandemic protocol, and media-driven fear.
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, we have to leave it there, Michael. This is a conversation that I could go on with for much longer, but we are at the end of our time. But thank you for taking the time to speak with me today about this and highlighting something that I think is very important and should not be forgotten as these bizarre narratives continue to proliferate. So thank you.
You're welcome. I'll have a paper next week out on all the things that happened in Northern Italy.
Excellent.
Thanks, Jesse.
Take care.